The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new episode of One Nation Indivisible. I am back, and we are at war with Iran. I'm back from a much-needed vacation, first vacation my better half and I have been on without children or family in 8 years, which I'm told by everybody is untenable and tend to agree. Did anything happen while I was gone? Yes. Did we almost not make it back from Mexico? Also, yes. We are back. We are safe. We're getting ready for the Freethought cruise, which we're very excited for. I don't think there's time to sign up anymore, unfortunately, but really looking forward to cruising with some of you beautiful freethinkers. There's a lot to cover, and I can't cover it all because so much did happen, but we are going to get into a few of the things, and we're going to open with the real reason for the war in Iran, which is the Epstein files. I mean, I think, right? I was texting with my college friends the other day, and Mike, just a beautiful human being, started off the conversation. He's like, so we're really going to war to avoid talking about the Epstein files, to distract from the files? And it kind of does seem like that. You know, just a few days before, in fact, on the day of the State of the Union, which I'm not going to cover because it was fucking horrendous. On the day of the State of the Union, NPR broke what I think is the biggest story that's not really being covered or not being covered enough and should have, you know, like so many things in this day and age, should have ground the world, at least the United States, which is political world, to a halt. And that is that the Trump DOJ under Pam Bootlicker Bondi withheld files from the Epstein document drop. And not just any files, files relating to allegations that Donald Trump sexually abused, assaulted a minor, a 13-year-old girl. Now, Dems rightly are saying that this is illegal. Again, there is a law mandating the release of these files, all of the files, not just those files that are less politically and less criminally damaging to the sitting president, but all of the files. And what we're talking about, I'm just going to read from the NPR story. The story is linked in the show notes. I'm going to quote here the NPR story, which says, quote, "The woman who directly named Trump in her abuse allegation," so these are the files that we're talking about that appear to be missing. "The woman who directly named Trump in her abuse allegation claimed that around 1983, when she was around 13 years old, Epstein introduced her to Trump." And now they are quoting internal, so this is a quote within the NPR story. Quote, "who subsequently forced her head down to his exposed penis and which she subsequently bit. In response, Trump punched her in the head and kicked her out." That's the end of the quote and the end of the quote from the NPR story. So doubling, closing both quotes there. So these are the files that the DOJ did not include, as they were required to do by law in the document drop. So again, these are allegations, and what apparently is missing are the FBI interviewed this person, and there's 50 pages of notes or so from those interviews that were not included in the document drop, but were supposed to have been. So this is a cover-up. I mean, that's what it is. Now, it's certainly possible that the DOJ, Pam Bondi and them think this isn't real, this isn't a real allegation, therefore we're not going to drop these files. But that's not what the law says. The law says you doesn't say anything about you getting to make a political calculation about this. It's you have to release those files. There are some exceptions, but nothing that would fall under here. So it is a cover-up. They are, now again, maybe they're covering up the allegations as opposed to, I'm not speaking to the truth of them, but it's still, they are still covering this up. And this would be, I mean, again, grind absolutely everything to a halt. I mean, Epstein introduced her to Trump, who subsequently forced her head down to his exposed penis, which she subsequently bit. In response, Trump punched her in the head and kicked her out. That's the quote in the NPR story. I mean, yes, I am at a loss for words, because one, of how fucking horrible this is. Two, thinking about like the absolute scandal of Bill Clinton and what happened to his presidency when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. And also, just, I don't know if you all have seen what Monica Lewinsky has done lately, but mad props to her. She's just an amazing person. And this, to me, ought to be the biggest story. I think it is partially why we're invading Iran. I don't think that the claims of nukes are credible. I'm shocked that there are one or two Democrats who are not on the right side of the war powers debate here. Just to be clear, what I mean by that is that Congress has the power to declare war. Congress has not declared war, and yet Donald Trump is essentially waging war on a foreign country, even though there is no war declared. There is effectively a motion in Congress, a move in Congress to have the debate about the war powers, and they can say, yes, we're at war with Iran. We're worried Iran has nukes, but they haven't done that. And there are those in Congress, including two Democrats, who are not even willing to have that debate. Just say Trump gets to do what he wants, which for this president is like the most insane thing ever. Just at least have the balls to do your congressional job. But I mean, as we have learned, this Congress is nothing if not unwilling to do its job. And apparently that's both sides of the aisle. I think it's too easy to rip on Democrats, but there are two here who are not. And we're going to name them, but I have to look up their name. And it's worth noting Thomas Massie, again, who's a crazy person, but is right on the Epstein files, is also right on this. So reading from The Hill, Representatives Ro Khanna and Thomas Massie have sponsored this war powers resolution, which is, quote, designed to reassert Congress's authority to declare war as delineated in the Constitution. It's not expected to pass, given the overwhelming opposition of Republicans and at least two Democratic allies of Israel, Representatives Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey and Jared Moskowitz of Florida. So Gottheimer and Moskowitz of Florida are giving Trump unfettered power to wage war, even though it is Congress. Forget what you think about the war. Forget what you think about Iran. Doesn't the existence of a nuke or not is irrelevant to the debate of whether or not Donald Trump should be able to unilaterally bomb another country, invade another country, wage war on another country. That's the question, and the Constitution is very, very clear that that power lies with Congress. If representatives and senators, if Gottheimer and Moskowitz think that Trump should have that power, then they should vote to give him that power regarding Iran, not refuse to assert their constitutionally mandated power. It is cowardice masquerading as strength. And if you are in New Jersey or in Florida, or especially if you're a member of either of their districts, please call Gottheimer and Moskowitz and tell them that they need to change their mind on this. Again, it's not about, they can still vote to approve in a war with Iran if they think that's important. If they think Iran has nukes, they can still do that. It's just make Trump explain that and don't give him the unilateral power to do whatever the fuck he wants. That is insane, especially with this president. It was just such a bizarre moment because I woke up Saturday and I was with the kids and I had not did my workout, had not checked the news. The youngest was up early doing things with them, trying to, you know, it's a really cold, nasty day. We're waiting for it to warm up a little bit and we're doing art. We're all sitting around the kitchen table. We're coloring, you know, doing arts and crafts. It was really relaxing. I did a color pencil drawing of, you know, a mallard and some mallard family, and it was, you know, super fun. And just as I'm sitting there having this moment of peace and disconnection from the world and connection with my family, we're fucking bombing another country so that these scandals at home can be subsumed in not only the news of that war, but also the coercive patriotism that comes along whenever America goes to war. It was a surreal moment. Much like, had a similar moment, though surreal for a different reason, watching the Olympics. I've probably not talked about this on the pod because we've only been around for a year now, but I've definitely talked about this with my OG supporters back in the Patreon days and the Buy Me a Coffee days when we were having other rounds of Olympics. I know I used to talk about this with folks. Like, the Olympics are one of my favorite things ever. I love the Olympics. And I think it's one of the times where I'm so proud of the United States. And I think The Olympics show one of the reasons our country is so cool, because without uniforms and without the flags, you know, you could never tell who was on Team United States or not, because we could be anybody, because our country is so diverse and so many immigrants and sons and daughters and children of immigrants come to this country that our names can sound like the names of any other country. We can look like people from any other country. And so, you know, you might see a name that would have the typical sound of a particular country. And it has an American flag next to that name because the athlete is an American. I think it's just one of the things that's beautiful and makes me so proud to be an American, which I know is a silly thing to be proud of. But obviously, these were different Olympics. One, because the beauty of that is being assaulted, or the principle underlying that beauty is being just assaulted and undone by Donald Trump and his goons and ICE. And I realize that this is becoming, maybe is, one of the things that Donald Trump has ruined too. And I was really holding on to it and able to, because, you know, some of the athletes are, they're so brave and they're speaking out and they're saying, I don't agree with this. And I love that kind of courage. And again, these are just people who would, I'm sure, love to be disconnected from politics and just love to do their job and love to play their game as hard as they can. But sports has long been political, despite what people will say. And from a but what I'm saying is basically from a geopolitical standpoint, like, I don't think our country deserved to win shit, which is not, again, not fair to the athletes. I 100% admit that. And, you know, so again, some of them were brave enough to dissent. But what we are doing to the world is, and to the people who represent us abroad or is here at home, is terrible. And then, you know, other things like, Donald Trump ruined the West Wing for me. I tried to rewatch it. I did rewatch it, but it's still kind of like, oh man, this is, I love the show. One of my favorite shows of all time. The writing's phenomenal, but it's so unrealistic looking back. The idea of a principled Republican temporarily assuming power and then handing it, I mean, come on. What is a principled Republican these days? It's somebody who doesn't have a job. And of course, we're leading up to the men's hockey team here and their gold medal game, which I did again, watched with the kids, the family. Like, I have, for those of you who don't know, I have three boys. Don't talk about them often as a way to protect them and the family. I'm not going to give their names or ages here, even because I've had too much serious threats come my way. But you know, this was watching this great game with my boys. Overtime victory. I mean, just a huge win, an amazing game. And I was just so thankful afterwards that they did not see the failure of the U.S. men. These are men, not boys, as some pundits have said, not kids. These were men. Thankfully, my boys, who are boys, didn't see these men utterly fail the basic moral test after the game in the locker room when the president of the United States calls them and drags them into the sucking failure of his presidency and worse, just the moral bankruptcy of his humanity. I mean, this is in a fucking locker room, right? This is the emblematic shithole for men to be awful to women. Men, led by the president of the United States, were awful to women. Just making them, who are better athletes and the better team, hands down, the butt of a joke. And again, the women's team is significantly better than the men. So these men fail just a test. They failed basic humanity. And then look, I'm sure some of you are annoyed with me right now and want to defend them. I will admit the situation was hard. I will admit the video doesn't show the entire team, but I also haven't seen still to this day any disavowals or statements from any of those players. I haven't seen any of them apologize. They didn't bother to boycott the State of the Union. They fully committed to being Trump's little bitches on this whole thing. And I was just so thankful that my boys, my kids, didn't see that embarrassment. And I wonder if they should have, and they should have seen the illusion of that victory shattered or not. So that I could teach them that it doesn't matter if you're a gold medal athlete, if you're a shitty human being. And the lovely postscript to that story is that the women's team is partying in Las Vegas with Flavor Flav, who's the hero we didn't know we needed. We also heard from the U.S. Supreme Court what the New York Times said was their Declaration of Independence. Man, did the New York Times get that wrong. I'm talking, of course, about the tariffs decision, which we knew was coming, which we predicted on this show was going to strike down those tariffs. I am one of the most critical people out there chastising the Supreme Court, and yes, Even I was pretty sure the Supreme Court was going to strike down the tariffs. This was not a surprise to anybody who pays attention to the court. And in fact, there is and has been, but there is a compelling case to be made that this plays right into the rise of authoritarianism and the rollback of democracy. And that this is not only something you would expect from a court that was aiding and abetting the rise of authoritarianism, but that you could predict. And the amazing, wonderful, brilliant hosts of Strict Scrutiny predicted that earlier this year. They had a guest on. So this is the January 5th episode. It's linked in the show notes. They had Princeton professor and an expert on the rise of modern autocracies, Kim Lane Shepley, on to break down how Trump is consolidating power over Congress, over the executive branch, and the courts. And basically, Professor Shepley predicted this exact result, basically during this episode. I would really encourage you all to go listen to this. And I think even to the point of the lack of remedy and the shitty response from the media, though she didn't use the word shitty. That's just me being me. And essentially, one of the professor's points is that, look, the rise of modern authoritarianism doesn't come at the point of a gun, right? It's actually not the picture of a tank rolling over somebody in Tiananmen Square, right? It is, the modern authoritarianism is aided and abetted by the courts, and it is primarily legal, with quotes around that for whatever that means. And so one of the hosts, I believe it was Melissa Murray, asked Shepley, the Supreme Court is what they cover on that podcast. And Shepley was talking about the Orban regime. And Melissa Murray was like, well, what are you seeing in our system? That's this backsliding or this new way that the courts are kind of approaching this and aiding and abetting the rise of authoritarianism. And Shepley said, look, where I see this is in the tariffs case. And the first thing she points out is the speed of the tariffs case, because the court does all kinds of crazy things on emergency schedules, right? The shadow docket, we've talked about it on this case, or excuse me, on this pod. And in this case, on the tariffs case, they just went at this normal snails, turtles pace that they go at, even though it's doing massive damage to the economy and to the people. Trump's, continually wreaking havoc across the economy with his tariffs announcements. The court could have acted quickly, but didn't. And the reason she said it didn't is because they're giving him a chance to kind of do all of this stuff. And then when the court does decide to lower the boom, which she expects, it's kind of not going to matter. Because so much of the damage has already been done. In other words, he's already consolidated so much power. She does a much better job of describing this than I did, but I would really encourage all of you to go listen to that episode. It's linked in the show notes. But the way that I will sum it up is effectively like, the court's doing this thing, and one, it's actually going to help Donald Trump. Not only is it going to give him time to consolidate power, it's also going to give him an excuse to not do a thing that is super, super harmful that he's been doing, but he can't walk it back because it's an authoritarian, but he should walk it back because it's doing massive damage across the board, right? So it's something that he ought to be doing on his own, not doing these tariffs is what I mean. He ought to stop doing the tariffs, but he can't. And so the court's going to give him an excuse to be able to do the thing he should do. And then you're going to get the media buying into that and just holding up the court as this great independent body. So it's also giving the court the illusion of being independent, an independent body, of standing up to Donald Trump, of not constantly aiding and abetting everything he's doing, even though that is what they did in this case in a way. And that is, to me, just was I was listening to this episode at the beginning of the year back when I was on my family road trip. And it's just like, yeah, Professor, you nailed it. And the media just really walked in to that rake, really stepped on it. The New York Times had an absurd fucking headline and shitty article. The headline is, quote, "The Supreme Court's Declaration of Independence." Subhead, "The court's rejection of President Trump's tariffs program is the latest in a series of clashes between him and the Chief Justice." Washington Post, same thing. "Handing defeats to Trump, Supreme Court signals potential course change." No. It said, don't do that. That's it. That is the most you could say of that decision. And even then, the reasons it gave were not great. But there were no consequences in the decision. There was no remedy given, right? Nothing about Trump having to pay this back to the American people. Nothing. Nothing but words. The court let Trump and the 1% fuck us, the 99%, for a year before doing what was in everybody's best interest, what the law required, obviously. I mean, the law on this was so clear. And then they get all, this court gets all these unearned plaudits for doing less than the bare minimum. Right? I mean, and if you're struggling to remember, right, this was an interpretation of an esoteric statute. That was the kind of legal question underlying this case, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, right? It was just, what does this law say? This was not a rebuff of Trump. This was not a restructuring of the court's relationship with Donald Trump. And it was certainly not a declaration of this court's independence from the billionaires who paid their way onto this court. They are still beholden to the forces that captured the court. And again, to me, that these headlines, these go to that value that the media has, where they value and they prefer balance over truth and accuracy. And they're balancing themselves out here. These writers have been a little bit more critical of the court than they normally would and have been looking for a way to give the court some plaudits, and they do it here. I mean, my genuine opinion of this is that this whole spat between Trump and the court is like a professional wrestling grudge. Now, maybe Donald Trump is not smart enough to realize this, but it's kayfabe. None of this is not a real declaration of independence. These are not real fights between them. Donald Trump's vitriol directed at them is not some sort of, you know, signal to them in the future that if they try to do the same thing when he tries to do his emergency regulation of the election, like, it's none of that stuff. It's all bullshit. It's all fake. There's one other court decision that I want to cover, and that is the Ten Commandments decision that came out of the Fifth Circuit regarding the Louisiana Ten Commandments law. Whew. You know, the decision's definitely better than an outright law. So let me just read a couple. It's hard to know where to begin here because it's such a bad decision. Basically, the court kicked the case out because it claimed, we don't know enough about what is going on. Basically said, like, we need to see one of these displays go up before we can decide the constitutionality of this, which is very silly. And we'll get to that in a second. There's one line that I want to read, or a couple lines that I want to read. So this is a quote. There's some internal quotes here, which I'm not going to quote, and I'm not going to read the case citation, but quote, "There can be no doubt that the Ten Commandments bear immense religious significance. For believing Jews and Christians, they are the word of God handed down to Moses on Mount Sinai. But they also have historical significance as one of the foundations of our legal system." Now, this is taken by the court as truth, but it's never been proven as such, and it is not true. It is untenable and unproven. And if you take the time to investigate that claim that the Ten Commandments are one of the foundations of our legal system, if you investigate it, like, at all, it doesn't hold water. That was my Marissa Tomei impression that was not very good. Sorry for that. But my cousin Vinny, you know? Anyway, go read The Founding Myth. The Ten Commandments are not the basis of our legal system. In fact, they run counter to most of the principles found within our legal system, including religious freedom, freedom of speech, the presumption of innocence, not punishing innocent children for the crimes of their parents, you know, to name a few. But the court again kicked it out because it claimed it didn't know enough. And it makes this ballsy, unsubstantiated claim, right, about the Ten Commandments being a founding part of our legal history. But then says, oh, well, we don't know enough about what these school displays are going to look like. Quote, we do not know, for example, how prominently the displays will appear, what other materials might accompany them, or how, if at all, teachers will reference them during instruction. More fundamentally, we do not even know the full content of the displays themselves. And look, this, I mean, guys, this is just simply not true. We know those things. We know the size, we know the text, that they will be prominently displayed. We know the bare minimum. We know what to expect at the very least. Might more go up? Yeah, classrooms might have other things go up. It's possible, I guess, but there's no real reason to think so, right? There's no real reason to think they're going to add to these displays. And I'm pretty sure Louisianans are familiar with that saying about, what's it, something about lipstick on a pig, right? They can dress up these displays all they want, but it is still the state telling other people's children which God to worship to the exclusion of all others. Telling students that they do not have the religious freedom guaranteed in our First Amendment. Quote, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. That's what it says at the top of the Ten Commandments displays. That's what the state is requiring schools to tell to every single student. You can't dress that up in a way that is not un-American and unconstitutional. Again, the court said this was too abstract, and that their powers of imagination, they got really snotty here, were insufficient to the task of imagining a poster when they know the size, the location, the prominence, and the precise text that appears upon it. I mean, lack of imagination doesn't begin to cover it if that's the case. You've been a judge too long if you can't figure that out. James Ho, who we've talked about on this podcast several times, and is a Christian nationalist politician who happens to sit on the federal bench and who is whoring himself out in the most unseemly and transparent manner in order to win a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, had some things to say. And just a side note, we're not going to get into it, but there's a lot of rumblings about Sam Alito possibly retiring at some point, maybe this summer, and giving up his seat. It's related to the publication schedule for his upcoming book, which I guess I will have to read for y'all. And the speculation is by people whose opinion I respect, and the timing does suggest that something might be happening. So, you know, this is why James Ho is writing all these crazy things to get that seat. Here's some of the things that James Ho wrote in his opinion, which accompanied this decision from the Fifth Circuit. Quote, the law is constitutional and consistent with our founding traditions, end quote. No, it's not. That is not a tenable statement. It's not consistent with our founding traditions. There were no Ten Commandments displays at the time. And again, the government rewriting scripture is not something that would have flown at the time. Ho also says that Stone versus Graham, which is a case from the 1980s, which says that you can't have Ten Commandments displays in the public schools, only uses the secular purpose prong of the Lemon Test to adjudicate Ten Commandments displays. Remember, the Lemon Test is a case that's Lemon versus Kurtzman from the 1970s. Really important case that's being undermined and attacked because it's, in the minds of most lawyers, the source of much of the law surrounding the church-state separation, even though it's really just a synthesis of principles from the law that had existed before that. Anyway, he's saying, look, Lemon is no longer good law. Therefore, Stone is no longer good to law, and he can do what he wants, and he wants to impose his personal religion on other people's kids. He also argues that this is not coercive, that having a display which tells kindergartners, first graders, second graders, third graders, that the state has a particular God that they must worship to the exclusion of all others while they are in school, which they are required to attend by law, that's not coercive. Specifically, he writes, quote, passive religious displays are not coercive. And he cites, he cites three cases, none of which involve a public school. Well, okay, one of the cases involved a public school, but the quote that he uses from the case references a nativity scene that was on the steps of a county courthouse. He uses it to say that such displays are not coercive, but that courthouse creche was struck down in the opinion that he references. I mean, more to the point, again, none of those quotes from the cases he used were about schools, where students are required by law to attend mandatory compulsory attendance for hundreds of days and thousands of hours every year. They have no choice. They have to be in school, in those classrooms. They're required to listen to their teachers and the state when it comes to things like this. And in fact, look, I mean, that is the whole reason these laws are attractive to politicians in the first place. That's why they're putting them up in public schools. They want to force them upon kids. And kids have to be in public. That's why they're doing this. They get to act like the tobacco companies and get them while they're young. There's an old Billy Sunday quote. I thought it might be apocryphal, but when I was looking it up for this, I found it as early as 1914. And the quote reminds me of Ho's next argument. Billy Sunday preached, "If there is no hell, a good many preachers are obtaining money under false pretenses." Right? If there's no hell, a good many preachers are obtaining money under false pretenses. Which he's using as an argument to say there must be a hell. And it was just like, so you're so close, Billy, you're so close. That's not an argument for hell, that's an argument against hell and tithing and preaching. Right? That's what you're arguing against. And this is, I was reminded of it when I was reading Ho's argument, which goes like this, quote, "Moreover, we couldn't regard a passive display of the Ten Commandments as coercive without overturning established precedent permitting the daily recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance in public schools. After all, if a mere display is coercive, then surely an audible daily recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance every morning for one's entire public education is too." End quote. Yeah, man. This is just such a shitty, insulting argument. First of all, you're requiring the daily recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance. Like, and this is like, the history of the Pledge of Allegiance in public schools is just fraught with violence and shows how coercive it is. There's a decision called Gobitis, and this is actually one of the quickest, we've talked about this on the pod, one of the quickest Supreme Court turnarounds in history. The Supreme Court decided this decision called Gobitis in 1940, and it basically said, yeah, schools can totally force kids to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And there was such a backlash from around the country against Jehovah's Witnesses, mostly, and probably a few other kids who didn't want to say the pledge and who were still trying to refuse to say it. I mean, violent backlash. Thousands of cases documented that in 1943, and after some serious turnover on the court changed its mind and said, in a very famous case, one of the more beautiful cases in Supreme Court history, Barnett, and said, no, we are not going to, kids have a right to opt out if they want to. But the point is, yeah, this is coercive. Telling kids that they have to stand for a patriotic pledge that includes saying that we are a nation under God is coercive. Forcing them to opt out of that and out themselves as either unpatriotic or not religious or somehow different when they're in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and may not even understand those things is coercive. It's not that you can't declare it so, James Ho. It's that you don't want to. And those aren't the same thing. James Ho's likes and dislikes do not dictate what is constitutional and what is not. And then, because I am prescient, he quotes John Adams, "Our Constitution is only for a moral and religious people." And if you remember, I did an entire episode on this quote, moral and religious people, because it is one of the favorite quotes of Christian nationalists. They love to trot it out, and it doesn't prove what they think. James Ho thinks that means he gets to put the Ten Commandments in school. What it actually means is that when the Founding Fathers were writing our Constitution, they were not using religious principles to do so. They thought that morality and religion were distinct. And if morality and religion are distinct, there's absolutely no reason that the public schools need to be teaching religion as a substitute for morality, imposing religion on kids as a way to make them moral. They can just teach them to be moral without God. All right, last, we got to cover two other pieces of Trump government news, one involving the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, and the other involving Mike Huckabee, who is the ambassador to Israel. And we're going to start with Huckabee, who, you're going to have weird feelings about this. Just buckle up and get used to it. Mike Huckabee was interviewed by Tucker Carlson, and it is both fascinating and terrifying. We're going to listen to a couple of clips and we're going to talk about them. They get onto the topic of Israel, and Huckabee explains that the Bible says the Jewish people have a right to all of this land. Let's listen to that clip.
Here's the point. We're talking about Christian Zionism. The idea that as a Christian, I believe in both the Old and the New Testament. Why wouldn't I? I'm a person of the book. There are 80 million evangelical Christians in the United States. What makes us who we are is our adherence to the scripture, our right. belief that the Bible, all of it, not part of it, but all of it, is the word of the living God.
Yeah.
So if I believe in the Old and the New Testament, I do believe that there is a very specific call to the Jewish people that started with Abraham, and he called them out of what is now modern-day Iraq, said, come where I send you. He came. This is the land. Genesis 12:3, he says, I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. In Genesis 17, he looks out at the world. He says, look, and this is where I'm giving you the land.
I think
and
it's
since
my time, there
have been people living in this land
right.
connected to that moment of history. So there is a historical connection that
I'm
is
not
unbroken.
Even...
Okay, so you hear Huckabee cite Genesis a couple times there. And then there's some more exchanges, more back and forth on this same point. And Tucker is pushing. And then Tucker really pushes. And let's listen to this exchange. And we're going to listen to Tucker ask these questions and then pay attention to Huckabee's answers here. And Tucker goes back at him, but Huckabee's answer is startling.
That's where we started.
I'm not
going
to let you off on this because you have
Go
said
ahead.
It three times
okay.
that God gave this land
yeah.
to this people. And so it is entirely fair for me with respect to ask, what land are you talking about? Because I just read Genesis 15, as I have many times.
Mm-hmm.
And that land, I think it says, from the Nile to the Euphrates, which is, once again, basically the entire Middle East. So God gave that land to his people, the Jews, or he didn't. You're saying he did. What does that mean? Does Israel have the right to that land? Because you're appealing to Genesis.
Yeah.
You're saying that's the original deed.
It would be fine if they took it all. But I don't think that's what we're talking about here today.
What would be fine? Well, it's exactly what we're talking
well,
about today.
But here's what I don't think
you think it would be fine if the state of Israel took over all of Jordan?
They don't want to take it over. They're not asking to take it over.
But you're saying that the reason that Israel is legitimate, has this inherent right to exist, is in part because mm-hmm. God gave it to his people. And I am going to the same Bible that you're referring to and noticing that that is a huge piece of land. So if God gave them that land, then they have a right to take it now by your definition, unless I'm missing something.
Okay, so you, I have weird feelings about it. I'm sure you do too. This is actually such good questioning. And I really hate to compliment Tucker, but this was so good and so well done. He's forcing Huckabee to justify the absurdity of his religious beliefs and those religious beliefs dictating public policy. Which, again, wouldn't happen in a country that separates church and state. So maybe Tucker could do a little bit to fight for that. Yeah, I know. Hilarious. Now, but it's also interesting because this is something that I don't think you would see in the mainstream media ever. And that's not because the mainstream media doesn't understand that Huckabee's theological beliefs are impacting public policy. It's because the media, the journalists, the networks would never want to do anything that could be seen, or more importantly, could be characterized by the conservative media as anti-religion. Or as hurting somebody's religion and subject them to that criticism. And this is a huge, huge weakness for this country and for our democracy and for the separation of church and state. The mainstream media wouldn't do anything that would make them vulnerable to claims, to attacks, especially from the conservative media, that would make them appear anti-religion. Even though white Christian nationalists are using their religion to inform and dictate public policy. They are making their Bible the law of the land. They are legislating the laws of their God onto all of us. And we have to pin them down on questions like this. This is one of the reasons I wanted to share this. And I feel forced to praise Tucker here. We have to ask these questions. Interviewers have to stop being afraid of being seen as anti-religion and start being afraid of what will happen when Christian nationalists have consolidated power and we no longer have the ability to ask these questions. We no longer have the ability to challenge foreign policy decisions that are based on one of the most ancient books in human history. When we no longer have a free press, when Trump's billionaires have bought up all the media outlets, which apparently is we're on the verge of, and we have one-party control of the media. I wanted to get to talking about Doug Wilson at the Pentagon. We've already covered Doug Wilson and what's going on at the Pentagon pretty much ahead of everybody else. I'm not gonna do that at this particular time because we're running very low on time. I'm actually going to get a guest. I'm going to try to get Brian Kaler, who when we were talking about this before, I mentioned has done a great job of covering this for his Substack, Word and Way. I will just say this in conclusion. You know, again, life's too good to waste on bad ideas. Hopefully I'll come on the cruise with me. But I'll also say that to whoever wrote fuck Trump and Trump is a pedo in the bathroom in the Cancun airport, bravo. I salute you.
This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.